And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin. Who's Talking, featuring interesting guests from our community on News Talk 1360 WCATL. Now, here is D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Earlier, I visited with former U.S. Senator Robert Morgan with the idea that I would talk about his political career. I think, fortunately, we talked about the political career primarily of other people, but I persuaded former Senator Morgan to visit with me again, and he's agreed that we can concentrate on his political career rather than that of others. Senator Morgan, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm enjoying it.
Well, it's sure been great for me, and I've learned a lot about North Carolina that I did not know in terms of politics. We were talking about your career as a state senator, and I'd like to continue that. One of the, when we talked earlier, you expressed your admiration for President Friday, now a hero for all of us, at particularly with respect to his television program. But back in the 1960s, when you were in the state senate, another defining moment in North Carolina political history came up with this speaker ban law.
Right.
And this was something that, at least as I read, this was something that you felt was an important positive step to take, and you defended it. Looking back at it, could you describe how that issue came up and how it became to be such a controversial issue and sort of how you all finally dealt with it?
Well, first of all, let me tell you that I had no interest in it, except as a lawyer. I was not even present when Thad Ure put the speaker ban law out. I was out at the national meeting. And what happened, the reason I got so much publicity, I was employed by the State American Legion to defend the oppose this. Well, let me go to
oppose the repeal, I guess. Or
yeah, that's right. And I appeared before the committee, the governor's committee, and that's how I got named as being for the speaker ban law. But interesting enough, later on, at the request of the UNC Teachers Association, it has another name, I made a speech, and every word that I said came right out of the National Association of Professors and so forth, and the people agreed with me. But, you know, it's interesting. Leo Jenkins, who was president of East Carolina, and I was chairman of the board. If you read the book on East Carolina, you will find that he and I came up with the solution to solve the whole problem, and that was to let each trustees make their own decisions, but it also put responsibility on them to monitor it, you know. What had happened in some of the universities was that nobody knew who was speaking. So Leo took the credit, and I was right with him, and it's in the book. I was chairman of the board, and he was president of East Carolina. So that's where a lot of the feeling that I was for the speaker ban law, I was not. I didn't have any didn't have any ideas at all. I was just an attorney representing the American Legion's position.
What was the, looking back at it, it's hard to reconstruct it. What was the position of people and entities like the American Legion who felt so strongly that this was something that needed to be done? And then where did you find how did you find the middle ground? I guess I should ask the first question first, which is, what was the position of the Legion?
There was no position, mainly with the University of North Carolina. You got to remember that Scales had been convicted of being a communist in the 50s. You remember him?
Yes, sir, and that was it's hard to remember that, but he was associated in a way with the university.
Yeah, and he went to prison. But after that, the University at Chapel Hill really did not monitor speakers. You know, they let the academic world decide who would be the speakers. And there were a number of well-known communists, you know, advocates. That was sort of a party back then. And that's what brought it on with Thad Year. He used to say, with both hands hanging up to the heavens, he said, "These hands wrote that speaker ban law."
That's when I was
in Oklahoma City at this legislative meeting. So it was a powerful thing, and it was after several hearings, and Senator David Britt was the chairman, appointed by Dan Governor Moore. But Leo Jenkins, and it was his idea, I'd like to take some credit, but anyway, together we recommended to that committee that we put the responsibility on the individual universities' trustees, in other words, required them to sort of monitor, and that worked out very well.
That became the state's sort of compromise way to get out of a situation that really nobody wanted to be in terms of the conflict with the university and the university supporters.
Yeah, that's right.
I want to move, if you're willing, to talk about when you began to think about running for higher office or for statewide office, and what were the options that you considered, and why did you decide to run for attorney general?
Well, it's sort of ironic. WRAL had a reporter for the legislature, and he came by one day and asked me if he could interview me. He said they're getting hot on me out at the channel, and I got at the TV, and I got to have some news. So he interviewed me. And I don't remember how the attorney general business came up. But anyway, he speculated that I was going to run. And I began to look into it, and sure enough, it was wide open, because up until that time, the attorney general just did the legal work. But he was in the early days in England, as far as the 1400s, he was known as the people's attorney. And when that came in, my campaign was... if the power companies are entitled to a raise, they'll have to prove it, because I'm going to be on the other side of the table challenging it. And remember, there were some of these COSCOT programs, you know, where you recruited other people. In other words, we took on consumer protection as one of our major projects. And we were very, very active. As a matter of fact, the last year that I served, and this is sort of self-aggrandizement, but I was selected by the National Attorney General Association as the most effective attorney general in America. And I was happy there.
Let me, I keep interrupting you, but what was the campaign like, and were you just unanimously elected, or did you have to run a campaign?
Oh,
and
I had to run against Wade Bruton.
You had to run against an incumbent.
Yeah, and Wade was a fine man. You know, he prosecuted the German people after the war. But the whole AG's office had never been anything but just the governor's legal status. And I took it in... and made it an active thing. And we did our research on it and went back and found out that the role of the Attorney General in the 1400s, 1500s in England was to protect the public.
That's interesting, and it also reflects back that to the sort of progressive or populist view that Dr. Lake had with respect to the need for regulation. Careful oversight of the monopolies.
That's exactly right. And I think maybe I got a lot of that from Dr. Lake's philosophy.
What else did you find that needed to be done or that you could do in the Attorney General's office?
Well, the first day, I was sworn in on Friday afternoon.
What year would this have been?
In 1969. And then I went, and the next Monday morning, I appeared before the Utilities Commission opposing a rate increase request for Duke Power. And I said to them, in effect, if you're entitled to it, prove it, but I want you to know we're going to be on the other side of the table challenging. And we were very successful in it. As a matter of fact, later on, the utilities put that power in the Utilities Commission, you know, which is usually appointed by the politicos. But I did those things, and there was a man named Turner that was selling Coscot, you know, stuff.
Pyramid scheme kind of
thing? Pyramid. And he was getting rich all over the country, and we took him to court. And I tell you one other thing I'd like for the public to know, and I wish we had it now. About that time, the Revenue Department had three investigators, and they didn't want them. I mean, they were changing their plan. So I hired them, and they were my consumer protection agents. And they'd go into grocery stores and go through and check out stuff to find out whether or not the people were being paying too much or what prices were misleading. And that, we became consumer-oriented, and I wish we had it now.
Well, we do have some of it. We take it for granted, though.
My experience under the present one is if you have a problem, you call the Consumer Protection, and they will send you a form to fill out, and I haven't heard from any of them.
Is that right? Listen, we're visiting with former U.S. Senator Robert Morgan. We're talking about his time as Attorney General, and in a little bit we'll talk about his determination to run for the U.S. Senate. He and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with former U.S. Senator Robert Morgan, and he's telling me about old-time political times, but we're about to move into new times. Yeah, we've talked about you as a active attorney general, and during the time that you were attorney general, somehow it must have gotten in your mind that you would run for different offices. What offices did you consider, and how did you happen to settle on the Senate?
Well, coming back to the attorney general's office, I had been observing it, and tell you the truth, the attorneys were not given the leeway to do these things. So I began hiring. I said, if our attorneys are not capable, we will hire some that will or are. And I'm proud of the fact the first five attorneys that we hired included Burley Mitchell, who later ended up being Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court, Sid Eagles, Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals. In other words, I hired responsible people.
You sure did, yeah.
Let them do their job.
So you got that consumer protection thing going. And,
yes.
But then how did that lead to your feeling that you should that you might want to run for higher office? What was happening in the Senate?
Well, I was in my second term, and the president of Carolina Power and Light Company from up in one of the counties near Greensboro, or no, Harris. Anyway, he came to see me one day, and he said, "Robert, if you're going to run for the U.S. Senate, now is the time." Said, I took Senator Irvin to a dinner the other night, and said, he turned around to me and said, Sherwood somebody.
Sherwood Smith? Or?
Yeah, yeah. He said, Sherwood, is that Morgan fella going to run? And he said, well, I don't know, Senator. I kind of think he might. And said he did jerk his head back. And Ms. Irvin said, well, I certainly hope Sam doesn't run. I'm ready to go home. And that was how we got into it. And had that, I don't know how I got enough nerve to do it, but I did it anyway.
But you'd been thinking about it before that, hadn't you?
Yeah, you know, I had all these bright young lawyers who wanted me to run for something. They wanted me to run for governor. And Carol Leggett, who was the chief deputy, wrote in his magazine that they took me out to the Chinese place on Hillsborough Street where they had booths, but they had high walls around them. And said they were, young lawyers were just aggravating me. And said finally I got sort of upset. I stood up and said, well, I'm going to run for governor. That's what they wanted.
Oh, you got up and said that?
Yeah, I stood up to them. But I said, I'm not going to ask a soul to vote for me. And I'm not going to ask anybody to contribute to my campaign. When that happened, a man that was in the booth next door who heard it stood up in his chair and leaned over that wall and said, fella, I don't know who you are, but I'll tell you one thing. You got one supporter for governor.
Well, now, who would you, if you'd run for governor, who would you be running? Who would you have been running against?
Let's see. That would have been 74. I don't know. Probably Jim Hunt. See, that would have been 74. Governor, I think, came about in 76. But I never had any inkling to run for governor. Because if you remember, the governor had, at that time, over 3,000 appointments to make. And all your friends felt like they were entitled to it. They were best qualified. So I could never be a governor.
Just because of turning down your friends who would be lining up for appointments to the various boards?
And the responsibility of all of those things. And we see it in almost every governor.
When you first started thinking about running for the U.S. Senate, as you mentioned, the popular, I guess, Sam Irvin, because of the Watergate thing, was the incumbent. And did you seriously consider running against him?
Yeah. Because Senator Irvin, it was generally thought he ought to come on home. You know, he'd been there forever.
So you'd run a campaign not so much against him as it's time, he's done well, let's bring him home for a good rest. That would be the theme of the campaign
I think so, and I had nothing but high regard. He wrote the best opinions when he was on the Supreme Court of any justice that I ever read about, you know, followed. I had high regard for him. In fact, I named his son to be a federal judge in the Fifth Circuit.
Right, but there was but you were considering running against him.
Well, no, I don't tell you the truth. I hadn't even paid any attention to it. But the speculation was, and Sharon Harris is the one that brought it up with Sam Irvin. I hadn't said anything about running for Senate.
So, but I'm just trying to, I love to put myself in the shoes of people who are making these hard decisions. So when the word kind of drifted back to you that Senator Irvin probably wasn't going to run and almost certainly wouldn't run if you were the opposition, that sort of unleashed you to begin organizing.
Yeah, and you know, I think maybe that when you take President CPNL saying that to me, I think people or special leaders felt like that Senator Irvin had ought to retire.
It was a surprise to me when you told me earlier that that you got this word from the power company. Now,
yeah.
Now you had been, you and Dr. Lake were advocates of regulating and keeping your eyes on the power companies and being
That's right.
That you were not the let them loose to do what they think is right. So I'm a little bit surprised that they would be your supporters.
I think Sharon Harris, you know, he'd been in the legislature. I think he might have been a different kind of power, a utility president. He was very progressive.
And even with respect to the regulation of rates by the government on the power companies' attempts to get a fair profit, as they would put it, yeah.
I might tell you that after I left the Attorney General's office, the legislature put the powers to defend for you in the Utilities Commission, and they took my experts and so forth. And so that the defend against rate increases now is primarily in the Utilities Commission.
How did the talk a little bit about the Senate campaign? Was that a easy campaign for you? You'd run statewide campaign yourself for Attorney General, and you'd also run Dr. Lake's statewide campaign in 1960.
My recollection is, you know, Dick Galifianakis was in the primary, and I don't remember, you know, you hate to say it was not all that hard, but it was a good campaign, but I had been dealing with people all over the state as Attorney General, so, and quite frankly, I had... Since this had never been done by the Attorney General, it became very popular. And so I don't think, you know, I think we could have made it, even if Senator, well, I don't know. Don't want to even speculate on it.
Well, you would, any politician, former politician, would be forgiven for believing that he could have won a race against anybody. I mean, or at least that's the way I do with political campaigns that I didn't run. I say, well, I could have won, but you're more modest than you're of an older school. You're more of a gentleman than I am.
But anyway, it's interesting that Senator Irving never quite forgave me, but you know, I told you I did appoint Sam Irvin Jr. to the Federal Court of Appeals in Richmond. So one day when I was campaigning, they set up a luncheon for me at Holiday Inn, and Senator Irvin had to introduce me. And Senator Irvin's introduction was almost just this: well, you know, the senator, this was the second time a senator appointed my son to the federal bench, and you know I'm for him.
That was all he could come up with.
That's
well,
right.
I hate to keep pursuing this, but this is more of an indication that Senator Irvin might have felt, at least from time to time, that you'd pushed him out of the Senate by running, and that he couldn't, that he like you, believed that he couldn't beat you, and that to beat you, it would be too hard a campaign for him.
Well, let me tell you this. He never would say that he wasn't going to run. So we decided that with Charlie Venberry being my manager, that we would go to Washington and meet with some PR people. And I don't know how the senator found out about it, but about 3 o'clock in the meeting, we got a call from somebody in the Senate saying that Senator Irvin just walked in to the Senate chambers, carried a paper to the clerk, and turned around and walked right out and said he was not going to run.
I see.
But if we had not been preparing, I don't know whether he'd run or not. Ms. Irvin probably would not have agreed.
I'm visiting with Robert Morgan, former United States Senator. He and I'll be right back after this short break.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're continuing our conversation with former U.S. Senator Robert Morgan. Senator Morgan, before the break, we were talking a little bit about the decision to run for the Senate, and a little bit of dancing around with Senator Irvin because he wouldn't say whether or not he was going to run. Once that election, once you became the candidate, you didn't have the hardest time getting elected, did you?
No. That time we really did not. And of course it was traveling around, but I think the influence of Senator Irvin helped carry me too.
The when you were elected, you went to Washington. I don't want to say you were a stranger to Washington, because as Attorney General, you'd had to go up and visit and advocate for the state. But Washington was a strange place. Well, I'll tell you a story I heard last night that illustrates that, and then I want you to argue with me about it. But
all right.
I talked to a young man who serves in the North Carolina State Senate, and he said, well, I just sat on the door of where Senator Morgan's office was going to be, and I waited for him, and when he came up, he was carrying his own boxes and bags, and I helped him in the helped him carry him in the office, and I asked for a job, and he gave him to me because he didn't have his staff yet. Well, so, I mean, that's probably not true, but
I expect it is.
But assembling a staff and getting into the Senate, did you enjoy that process, or like many people found it to be a very tough
process? It was difficult, but mine was not as difficult because, you see, I had Carol Leggett, who had been the chief staff assistant attorney general, and several of those folks, and we recruited some others. We had a great staff.
So you brought your chief staff person from the attorney general's office, whom you had confidence in and were used to working hand in glove with, and trusted him to.
Right, and we brought Nick Weaver, who had been in charge of the Raleigh Senate at the Raleigh Attorney General's office, you know, a business manager. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't have any problem having good staff.
What did you find about the culture of the Senate as compared with the culture of the North Carolina Senate in which you'd served before you became Attorney General?
Well, I think as a rule it was good as the state attorney general. I mean, as a state senate. But, you know, you had more time in the state because there was so much going on in Washington, and you served only on two committees, and that's where your really hard work came. But it turned out after a while to be very good, and especially since Senator Byrd, Robert Byrd, was there.
How did you, we mourning his loss. How? What is your insight into Senator Byrd and his helping a young North Carolinian? Senator Byrd, of course, we found out, was a North Carolinian, at least
originally. We sure did.
Did he take care of you, or did he harass you, or what?
Senator Byrd had me over to his office and made me comfortable and offered to help me, and did help me in things that, you know, that we needed to work together on. And by the way, the memorandum I got yesterday is I knew he was born in North Carolina, but he was born and his mother died when he was 11 months. And his father gave him to his wife's sister in West Virginia.
I see.
And then they changed his name to Byrd. And, of course,
Know what his North Carolina name was? Do we?
You know, it's in the memorandum, but I don't have it for me, though. It was an unusual name, and it was in North Wilkesboro, in that area.
Yeah, North Wilkesboro up near, and maybe in between Wilkes and Ashe County.
Right.
In there. Well, did you go up with the intention of getting anything specific done, or did you just go up with the idea, I want to be a good United States Senator and to be sure North Carolina is treated fairly?
I had no program of my own, except as you say, to be a good U.S. senator, and I hope I did. Even if I did give away the Panama Canal.
Well, talk about the Panama Canal, because what a hot emotional issue. When as you study the history of unfair political results, this one has to be right in there. As I remember it, maybe a Republican administration had negotiated a treaty, but in any event, President Carter brought it to fruition, and you supported him in that. And all we heard was Panama Canal, giving away the Panama Canal.
And it really eventually defeated me. But when I got there, Senator Goldwater and Senator Helms introduced a resolution against any changes. And, of course, I respected Senator Goldwater, and, of course, Senator Helms and I were on fairly good terms. So I joined in it, which led the president to believe that I probably wouldn't vote for it. And I didn't. I just listened. Well, in 1976, Christmas, Senator Inouye, who was chairman of my committee on intelligence, I was told that he was going to send each one of us to a CIA station overseas. Now, we'd never been able to identify them overseas. Later on, I found that he only sent me, and he sent me to Panama. And a colonel in the Army was a CIA agent. He spent a whole week with me and pointed out that all that the Panamanians had to do to destroy it was to break the dam that furnished the water. When I got back to North Carolina, on Sunday night, I got a call from the president, who apparently knew I was down there, and said, I wish you wouldn't take a stand on it until I get a chance to talk to you. And my reply was, Mr. President, you don't need to talk to me. I've been down there, and I know what it's like, and I know we've got to do it. And, of course, later on, when the vote came, it took 67 votes to ratify a treaty. But his senator from West Virginia, Senator Randolph, was opposed to it, but he agreed, because Senator Byrd was a leader, to vote for it on the condition that his vote would not make the difference. So that means that my vote, as being one of the last ones, did make the difference. And, of course, you know what happened. It was used against me very much and helped to defeat me. Not altogether, but it did help to defeat me.
Did you ever, looking back at it, say, well, maybe I did the wrong thing?
No, I didn't, because after I was there, spent a week there, it was perfectly obvious to me that that canal was not going to continue unless we did something. Because, you know, President Eisenhower initiated it way back on the, and every president from Eisenhower right on through Reagan, they almost had it negotiated, but everybody was afraid to take the stand except Jimmy Carter.
Well, it has worked pretty well, at least for the first 30 years of Panamanian management and close American oversight, I would say, that they've gotten. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back and continue our discussion with former Senator Robert Morgan. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Bob Morgan, Robert Morgan, former U.S. Senator Robert Morgan. We're talking about continuing to talk about his political career. And although we don't have time to visit throughout your Senate career, the Panama Canal Treaty had to be one of the most poignant and tough and memorable issues that you had to deal with. Were there others?
One on Panama Canal is interesting that when I voted for it, I have a handwritten full-page letter from the president thanking me and congratulating me. Now, to follow that up, the morning after the election, when he and I both lost, the first person I heard from was President Carter telling me, and this is the exact words, he said, I would rather have lost myself than have had you to lose.
Oh, well.
He felt like he led me into it.
Well, what was the talk about the campaign for re-election. I interrupted myself because I asked you if there were other issues that were of great importance to you that you had to deal with and that caused you some agony or tough issues for you.
It was a tough election. The opposition put out millions of pamphlets, had me and John and Ted Kennedy in two columns, and it had Jesse Helms and a couple of more in the other one. And of course, they tied me every vote, you know, with Kennedy and I was voting for them and voting for that. And in addition, the shocking thing was that they had a TV ad in which you looked and you saw a big aircraft carrier coming toward you. And the next shot was, in toward the canal. Then the next shot was you saw the fantail going away from the canal. Mm. Well, you know, anybody would have thought that the aircraft carrier had gone through that canal. And somebody said to me, Robert, did you know that that aircraft carrier could not go through that canal? Where I made a mistake is I called Tom Ellis, you know, who was right. Senator Helms' protege, the master of deceit. And they pulled it, but if I had been smart enough to keep my mouth shut and let them keep on running it nearer to the election, I probably could have won.
But gosh, that's interesting. It raises the question because, as you pointed out earlier, when you first went to Washington, you and Senator Helms were on good terms. And you were on good terms with your support network that had gathered around you from the very beginning when you were campaign manager for Dr. Lake. Did you lose those friendships as a result of working with the Democratic majority in the Senate?
No, I didn't. First of all, it's interesting that Dr. Lake and I both supported Frank Graham for the Senate.
Yeah, we talked about that in our first session.
Right.
But I'm thinking about what the results were during and after your Senate service.
Well, it really did not deter. That was the Panama Canal issue. But
just ask you this. Mm-hmm. To your knowledge, was Dr. Lake able to vote for you in your reelection campaign?
Oh, yes, and led...
And he campaigned for you.
Yes. Uh-huh.
But he had to campaign in opposition to some of his friends in the conservative Democrat and in the Republican movement.
Well, you know, he was on the Supreme Court at that time.
So it was a quiet.
It was a quiet
kind of support. The now, were you similarly friends with his son, with Iberville Lake Jr., Chief Justice?
Oh, yes. He came to work as a deputy assistant attorney general. And later became Chief Justice. And I'm proud of the fact that three of my staff people later became Chief Justice.
That's incredibly amazing. That's on your Attorney General's...
Right.
Well, we talk about what happens on the day after a political loss. So you lost in the November election and had to pack up and come back to Lillington. Did you come back with a heavy heart, or did you come back happy to be home and surrounded by people? What was that like?
Well, you know, ordinarily I would have been very depressed, probably. But you may remember that I had a brain tumor operation a month before the term was out. Now, let me hasten to say it was not it was not cancerous, but they did have to operate and go into my skull to remove a growth off of my hearing nerve. So I went on to Florida and stayed with my sister for 3 or 4 months to recuperate. But other than that, you know, it worked out and the people were good to me. And so we got along.
You, I think everybody knows that you don't carry any imperial idea or imperial egoism is not the way anybody would describe you. But is used to describe some former senators who expect sort of special treatment all along. Do you work at that, or is that just something that you you do naturally?
Well, you know, I never, even when I was up there, I never got that air of being uppity, so to speak. And when I came back, I moved right back into the same community on a farm where I was born and raised, and I live within 2 miles of it now and still have the house where I was born as a sixth child with no lights and no electricity. So I knew what it was like, you know, to be on a farm and during the Depression.
Harnett County is known as one of the most conservative counties in North Carolina, places in North Carolina. Now, you came back and you'd been up there in Washington, kind of Wharton, with all those liberals. Did they give you a hard time about that when you came back home?
Oh, a few people did, but basically I think I voted the wishes generally for the majority of the people in this county. A lot of them, you know, most of them, my friends, trusted me to make the right decisions and never really gave me any hard time.
We've been visiting with former U.S. Senator Robert Morgan, and we've been talking about his political career. I'm going to try to persuade him to come back, and we're not going to talk about politics too much, maybe other people's politics, but to talk about some of the stories that he's heard about or seen in his time of being in politics since 1950. And so, Senator Morgan, thanks for joining us today, and I look forward to having you back real soon.
Thank you, DJ.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. It's DG Martin, Who's Talking. I'll be back right here soon.